From KUNC, this is Colorado Edition. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Henry Zimmerman. It's Monday, August 26th.
Today on the show, we'll float down the last wild river in Colorado.
Today's world, where most rivers have been dammed, diverted, and dewatered to the point where they're not functioning as rivers do, this river still has that functionality.
Plus, why more schools across the state are turning to a four-day school week.
That's coming up on Colorado Edition.
We've been hearing a lot about vaping lately. E-cigarette use is on the rise, and a growing number of experts are concerned. And that concern has taken on a new tenor due to a number of respiratory illnesses found across the country. Health officials are investigating the connection between these cases and e-cigarette usage.
Officials in Illinois last week confirmed a respiratory-related death and believe it was linked to vaping. Now, overall, state health officials and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are looking into just under 200 cases in 22 states potentially linked to vaping, and that includes a handful in Colorado.
Dr. Robin Dieterding joins us now to discuss what we know about these illnesses and their potential link to e-cigarette use in the state. Dr. Dieterding is a pediatric pulmonologist and medical director of the Breathing Institute at Children's Hospital Colorado. Welcome to Colorado Edition.
Thanks for having me.
We want to quickly talk about some of the vaping-related lung illnesses we're starting to see in Colorado. What have we seen over the last few years?
Vaping is something that's really become epidemic, and it's come upon us kind of like a hurricane. Colorado kids are vaping at record numbers and lead the nation in vaping. We have started to see this clustering around the country of these more acute cases, more sudden onset of illness that I think the CDC is now investigating. You know, looking back through our files, I think we have recognized that, you know, perhaps we have seen a case before that we didn't really know what we were seeing. We do see kids who vape that cough and can have increased cough. But this new entity, vaping-associated pulmonary injury, is what the CDC is tracking, and clusters of cases are occurring. There has been a death reported nationally, and Colorado is reporting, as of last week, three people that have this type of injury. So this is fairly new.
I'm curious, because vaping has been around for a couple years in the United States, a few years actually, if this is more a case of it takes a few years before we start to see these symptoms and can kind of reveal what this illness might be, or if it's a case of something in the way they're made changing recently.
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure anyone knows the answer to that. I think these current clusters are more than what we've seen. So we don't know what it is, whether it's new substance, whether it's mixing and matching, but there's clearly, I think, something new in the environment, certainly in the communities that are experiencing high numbers.
The Washington Post is reporting that officials are not sure whether the illnesses are due to the devices or the substances inside them. What do we know about how the substances in e-cigarettes are regulated?
These are totally unregulated. And we know that most contain nicotine, some very high amounts of nicotine, such that one pod could contain as much as a whole pack of cigarettes. And those have, nicotine has significant addicting properties for the developing brain. And then on top of that, you know, kids are adding things, or people are adding things. And so it's really hard to get on top of this. It is unregulated. Regulation really is needed to prevent what I think is a generation of potential addiction, impact on lung function, and now even risk of severe injury and death.
In your professional medical opinion, is there anything in the policy world that you'd like to see approach these issues that we're facing in terms of teen vaping?
Right now, there is no tax on any vaping product, like cigarettes. So they're actually much more affordable for kids. So we would like to see at least similar tax base on vaping products as cigarettes. Right now, in different communities in most of the state, a child 18 years of age can buy this. That puts you in the range of being a senior in high school and being able to share it. We think it should be increased to 21 with strict enforcement on businesses selling to minors. And then we think all the flavors should be banned. I mean, cotton candy and bubble gum have no place in prevention of any kind of smoking programs in any of these products. So I think those are three things that we strongly recommend at Children's Hospital and the Breathing Institute that can make a difference.
Robin Dieterding is the medical director of Children's Colorado Innovation Center and the chief of pediatric pulmonary medicine. Thanks for joining us.
Sure, thank you.
In the most recent legislative session, which ended in May, lawmakers failed to pass a new vaping and cigarette tax.
And now a quick look at the other headlines of the day. Two Colorado oil and gas companies, PDC Energy and SRC Energy, are merging. The new company will be the second largest producer of oil and gas in Colorado after Occidental Petroleum. Under the PDC name, the company will oversee drilling on more than 180,000 acres in Weld County.
A bipartisan poll from Pew Charitable Trust show 82% of Americans want Congress to pass legislation to invest in overdue repairs at national parks. That's up 76% from last November. Most of them said they would like Congress to dedicate more money, up to $6.5 billion over 5 years, to fix national parks, things like upgrading trails and visitor centers and maintaining historic structures. The project director of the Restore America's Parks campaign says the longer repairs are postponed, the more serious and expensive they become. Companion bills in the House and Senate would put money toward fixing those problems. They're co-sponsored by lawmakers from every state in the Mountain West except Wyoming. A bipartisan Pew polling team surveyed 700 Americans across the country by phone.
The Steamboat Springs City Council is set to vote tomorrow on whether to ask residents to approve a new property tax this November. The new revenue would fund expansion of the city's Fire and Emergency Medical Services Department. If passed, it would be the first time the city has collected property taxes in 40 years.
Now we have an update on a story we first brought you last month. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled that the state of Idaho must provide sex reassignment surgery, also known as gender confirmation surgery, to a transgender inmate, Adri Edmo.
She's now slated to be the first transgender woman in the nation to receive the surgery through a court order. And this ruling could have a far-reaching impact in the Mountain West and potentially across the nation as prison officials grapple with the rights and medical needs of transgender inmates. Amanda Peacher reports, but a brief warning, this story includes a mention of self-harm.
Adri Edmo is a transgender woman who has been housed in an all-male prison since 2012. She has twice attempted to castrate herself with a razor, unsuccessfully. Her lawyers say those attempts are clear signs that Edmo's medical treatment is inadequate. Now, the prison will have to provide the gender confirmation surgery Edmo has been requesting for years.
She was excited and happy to hear the news and really just experiencing tremendous sense of relief.
That's Lori Rifkin, Edmo's lead attorney. She says prison officials denied Edmo treatment for gender dysphoria. That's when someone's physical body doesn't match their gender identity, and it can cause debilitating distress.
What this decision stands for is a basic principle of our Constitution. It's a basic value of our country that we treat all people, including those in prison, with basic decency and dignity, and we do not ignore their suffering.
The Ninth Circuit agreed that denying Edmo the surgery constituted cruel and unusual punishment. In the opinion, the judges wrote that, quote, responsible prison officials were deliberately indifferent to Edmo's gender dysphoria in violation of the Eighth Amendment. The ruling could have a ripple effect in Western states and potentially across the nation as prison officials grapple with the rights of transgender inmates and their medical needs. Courtney Joslin is a professor of law at UC Davis, and she says more and more federal courts are ruling in favor of transgender inmates who sue for medical treatment, like hormone therapy.
I think this decision really is in line with an evolution that we have seen in the federal courts, a growing appreciation for this serious medical condition and a growing appreciation for the types of medical treatment that can be medically necessary for particular transgender people.
Michael Mushlin, professor of law at Elizabeth Hobbs School of Law at Pace University, says that in some ways, Adri Edmo's case is really simple.
If you have a serious medical need, no matter who you are, no matter what your condition is, if you're in prison, prison officials cannot be deliberately indifferent to that.
In a statement, Idaho Governor Brad Little called the ruling extremely disappointing and says the state will appeal the case to the U.S. Supreme Court. The High Court takes up very few of the cases that are filed, but Mushlin says it could happen because other circuit courts have ruled differently on this issue.
They have an argument for the Supreme Court to review the case because now there is a clear split in the circuits.
As of now, the timeline for ECMO surgery would be set during a status conference in mid-September with the Idaho judge who initially ruled in her favor. Again, ECMO's lead attorney, Lori Rifkin.
She suffers every single day while they have denied this treatment to her for years, and there can be no reason justifying Idaho's continued refusal to provide her care except bias.
Rifkin called the news of Governor Little's appeal to the Supreme Court unfortunate and reprehensible, but she believes both the lower court and the Ninth Circuit ruling supports ECMO's right to necessary medical care under the Eighth Amendment.
That's the basic principle, and that's been long established in Supreme Court precedent for more than 50 years. And I don't think that the Supreme Court will walk away from that.
Whether or not SCOTUS takes the case, the Ninth Circuit ruling doesn't mean that the Idaho Department of Correction will have to provide gender confirmation surgery to all transgender inmates. But it does set a standard for providing it to certain inmates for whom the surgery is deemed medically necessary. Adri ECMO is serving a 10-year sentence for sexually abusing a 15-year-old boy when she was 22. ECMO is scheduled for release in 2021 and is not eligible for parole. Per state policy, she'll be transferred to a state women's prison following the surgery. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Amanda Peacher.
ECMO's legal case is the focus of the podcast Locked from Boise State Public Radio and the Mountain West News Bureau. You can learn more by searching for Locked wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Colorado Edition from KUNC.
You may be familiar with the idea of a four-day school week. Maybe a school in your district has that schedule or is thinking about implementing it. And the Colorado Sun has found that more and more districts around our state are turning to this schedule mostly as a way to save money. Jennifer Brown joins us now. She's a reporter for the Colorado Sun and a co-author of a three-part series about the four-day school week that will be out tomorrow. Jennifer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Give us a sense, first of all, how popular is the four-day school week in Colorado?
Well, we were surprised to find out when we started looking into it that Colorado has more school districts on a four-day week than any other state in the entire country. So at this point, Colorado has 111 out of its 178 school districts that have asked for permission from the Colorado Department of Education to hold school 4 days instead of five.
Let's talk about why then. What are the benefits? Why are more schools turning to a four-day school week?
The number one reason is financial. And the number two reason, which is really strongly related, is teacher recruitment. So some of these areas, take Brighton, for example, they have a low average per pupil funding compared to all the districts surrounding them, and they are only able to pay their teachers there about $10,000 less annually. So they couldn't pass a bond to raise money for teacher salaries. So part of the reason they went to this four-day week is because teachers desire to have that schedule. So they've had a big boom in teacher recruitment up there, twice as many teachers applying for jobs in Brighton because they want this four-day week. So it's a one way for them to gain quality teachers. And other rural districts said that too. But there were other reasons out there that surprised me. It's not all about the money. You know, in rural Colorado, it's a lifestyle choice. You know, there are some districts like in Leadville that talked about how this will be healthier for their students and staff. They'll be more well-rested and rejuvenated when they have a three-day weekend every week. So the reasons were really varied.
In terms of the financial aspect, is there a sense of how much money this actually does save in terms of, say, teacher salaries?
One district was interesting to me. They are saving 50% of what they used to spend on hiring substitute teachers, because they realized almost all of their substitute teacher costs were coming on Fridays because everyone in town really was heading out to go watch the football game or the track meet that they were holding on Fridays. So school was pretty empty of students and full of substitute teachers. And now that they don't have school on Fridays, they've had a really significant drop in those costs. And most schools too, especially the rural ones, have seen transportation savings, not having to run buses 5 days a week.
How does this affect students and their academic achievement?
There has only been a few studies, and they're conflicting. There was one that looked at Colorado schools on the 4 day versus Colorado's on the 5 day and found that the 4 day schools were doing a bit better. But then there was a follow-up study that was focused on students in Oregon, and it instead looked at specific demographics of students instead of just the school-wide score, and it found that all students were affected in a negative way when they went to a 4 day week. But they found in particular, for some reason, boys had a harder time with the 4 day week than girls, and other things, like, for example, students who were living in homes that were in poverty, kids that qualify for free and reduced lunch, saw their reading scores drop more than other students after they went to a 4 day.
I'm curious, too, about parents, many of whom work a 5 day week, not a 4 day week. Is this hard for them?
Yeah, I think for most of the districts that have switched, the number one concern from the community was, wait a minute, what about child care on that 5th day? And now we're going to have to pay, you know, out of our pockets for that. What the districts report, though, is that initially parents are concerned about that and, you know, worried about the expense. But after the switch has been made, their satisfaction surveys are overwhelmingly in support of this 4 day school week.
Jennifer Brown is a reporter for the Colorado Sun. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Erin. It was fun.
It's tough to find a river in the West that still behaves like a Western river, one that rises and falls with the rush of melting snow. Most of the region's major streams are controlled by dams. That makes the relatively free-flowing Yampa River in northwestern Colorado unique. As KUNC's Luke Running reports, the people who depend on it are wondering how to best protect the river as water in the West grows more scarce.
That's the sound of river guides hammering stakes into the sand along a small beach inside Yampa Canyon. They're keeping 7 inflatable rafts from drifting downstream, where white water is churning, sending an ominous roar up the narrow sandstone walls. John Saunders perches on a rocky outcropping and points out the features of Warm Springs. It's one of the river's more technical sections. The water is beige and roiling, like a latte in a blender on high speed.
As the water comes around the corner, you start to see waves picking up, and you see some waves that are actually crashing and looks intimidating.
I'm part of a group of about 30 people, including water professionals and elected officials, on a 5-day trip through Dinosaur National Monument. It's organized by conservation groups, including American Rivers and the whitewater outfitter Oars. Saunders is one of our guides.
How many times have you run this stretch?
Oh gosh, that's a good question. 10 or 15 maybe.
And does it ever look the same?
No. It's a different story every time we come. What do you think when you look at it?
I think it looks scary.
I agree.
But this is a good illustration of what makes the Yampa so unique in the West. Its flow changes daily, and while that might sound like a small detail, its variability is a defining feature.
This river is a relic in some ways.
Kent Vertrees is the board chair of the river advocacy group Friends of the Yampa. At the end of a cold, rainy day on the river, we chatted at a narrow campsite called Compromise. It's a fitting name given the growing pressures on the Yampa and other rivers across the West.
In today's world, where most rivers have been dammed, diverted, and dewatered to the point where they're not functioning as rivers do or used to, this river still has that functionality.
And that's not by accident. It comes despite varying interests, cities, farmers, and recreationalists all wanting a piece of it. In the 1950s, environmental groups stymied an effort to dam the Yampa. But Vertrees and others know the day will come when the river could be more vulnerable.
We do have a lot of growth happening in Colorado, all of the states in the Colorado Basin. We've been far enough away to this point to preserve the flows of the Yampa.
The largest city along the Yampa is Steamboat Springs, and while the community relies on the river for its water, the valley's biggest users are farmers and ranchers.
Part of the ranch is right at Clark.
Jay Fetcher raises cattle along one of the river's tributaries. Part of his operation is growing hay for his animals.
And the amount of water it takes me to flood irrigate that meadow would take care of 3,000 people for 1 year if it were shipped to the Front Range.
Do you think that sometimes agricultural users get unfairly blamed for water scarcity problems, or?
I do think we get blamed. Yeah. And yet people want to eat. They do want to eat. Yeah.
That's the
and
trade-off.
They want to recreate. Right. They want to recreate.
With high flows this summer, the fishing, tubing, and rafting was good. But it was a different story last year when drought and record heat caused parts of the watershed to run dry.
It was a big deal, number one, because it had never happened before.
Aaron Light is the state engineer in charge of managing and measuring water in the Yampa and its tributaries.
And number two, it encompassed the entire Yampa River.
She had to turn off water to some ranchers to meet other water obligations downriver. That's when the Yampa became the newest member of a whole class of Western rivers, ones where there's more water on paper than in the river itself.
Sometimes we joke about it being, or maybe not joking, it's just a statement we use that it's the last frontier. And when it comes to water, I think we are the last frontier.
So far, no one's shown up on Jay Fetcher's doorstep looking to buy his water yet. But for agriculture to survive in the long term, he says, they need to make the case that their livelihoods are valuable.
I think with Colorado getting thirstier with more people, we who use the resource, the river, through our water rights, have to think about what other benefits are provided by our flood irrigation that Colorado enjoys.
Like the wetlands he says his flood irrigation creates that wouldn't be there otherwise. Back in Yampa Canyon, those same concerns weigh on Jackie Brown. She's a recent appointee to the Colorado Water Conservation Board. It's the state's decision-making authority on all things water.
I think we're really at a time in water development and in water resource management when we've built relationships to have the hard conversations.
Ones that include the contentious issue of pursuing federal protection for the river's flow, or demand management, a still theoretical program that would pay farmers to irrigate less and send the saved water to the Colorado River's dwindling reservoirs.
Something that I grapple with all the time is, what does rural Colorado look like in 2 years, and 5 years, and 10 years, and 50 years? That's the question we're asking ourselves right now.
It's a future that's still being written, and charting that course will be up to everyone who uses water in the arid West.
I think rivers that have a natural heartbeat, or what we're calling on this trip, the natural hydrograph.
Again, river guide John Saunders.
They tend to reflect a story, and so we're starting to see this story change, and every time we come down here, much like in our own lives, if we look at our own lives, every day is a different story. I think rivers reflect that.
There was one more point of reflection on the trip. When the raft slips silently into Echo Park, where the Yampa ends and meets the Green River.
Let's go that way first. Just yell Yampa as loud as we can. Staying silent for, let's say, a good 10 seconds. So you can count, try to count how many echoes you can hear, okay? One, two, three.
Yampa!
In Yampa Canyon, I'm Luke Runyon.
And we have one last thing before we go. Yesterday, the Colorado Classic Bicycle Race finished its fourth stage in Denver.
That's the sound of the race's winner, Chloe Dygert, crossing the finish line. The 22-year-old seven-time world champion and Olympic silver medalist dominated the field, coming in first in each of the four stages. Dygert won $75,000 in prize money. It was the first year that the race, which took place around the state, was women's only. Our producer Lily Tyson spoke to fans around the finish line about what that meant.
It's been really fun watching the women race. I've been watching this race for several years now, and it's exciting that it's an all-women race this year.
I run marathons and stuff, so I have never seen a bike race, and this is pretty cool because they fly by so much faster than runners. It's exciting, like banging in the barrier. It's fun, yeah.
Well, I've been a fan of women's cycling for years now, and this is actually the first professional race I've ever had a chance to see. So this is incredibly exciting for me. I've had a lot of fun watching the stages up till now, and I'm super psyched to be here in person.
I've been coming for as long as Denver's had the Colorado Classic, and even before it was the Colorado Classic, so it's really exciting that it's an all-women's race today, to finally get girls on bikes instead of just watching the men race.
And she also spoke with cyclist Maddie Ward, who we heard from last week. Ward came in 18th place in this year's race.
I don't think I've ever seen crowds this big. Every time I went through the start-finish, I got excited because people were banging on the barriers, just so loud, cheering us on. I heard my name all around the circuit. Like, it was just so fun.
And when asked if she'll compete in the race again next year?
Yes. I don't even hesitate. Yes, for sure. With this finish, yeah, I'm very excited going into 2020. Saying that is weird, 2020, but that's it. Yeah, I'm very excited.
Well, that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Colorado Edition, we talk with Luke Runyon about an upcoming water auction.
And we'll explore some of the latest moves in school safety. Colorado Edition is hosted by me, Erin O'Toole.
And me, Henry Zimmerman. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson. Brian Larson is our executive producer.
And thank you for listening to Colorado Edition from KUNC.